yet alluring and easily grasped by an audience that has likely never known you personally. When the work goes well, we keep such inner distractions at bay, but in times of uncertainty or need, we begin listening. We abdicate artistic decision-making to others when we fear that the work itself will not bring us the understanding, acceptance, and approval we seek. For students in academic settings, this trouble is a near certainty. You know, and you are correct, that if you steer your work along certain paths, 3 units of A can be yours. Outside academia, approval may be clothed in loftier terms, critical recognition, shows, fellowships, but the mechanism remains the same. With commercial art, this issue is often less troublesome, since approval from the client is primary and other rewards appropriately secondary. But for most art, there is no client, and in making it, you lay bare a truth you perhaps never anticipated, that by your very contact with what you love, you have exposed yourself to the world. How could you not take criticism of that work personally? Understanding. We all learn at a young age the perils of being perceived as different. We learn that others have the power to single out, to ridicule, to turn away from, and to mark the one who is different. Choose your own memories, but one way or another we've all felt the hurt of the little boy who wanted to write poems, or the little girl who tried to join the sandlot ball game. As an artist, you learn these lessons all over again, with a vengeance. In following the path of your heart, the chances are that your work will not be understandable to others. At least not immediately, and not to a wide audience. When the author fed his computer the question, "What works?" a curious pattern emerged. A consistent delay of about 5 years between the making of any given negative and the time when prints from that negative began selling. In fact, one now popular work was first reproduced in a critical review to illustrate how much weaker the then new work had become. Performing artists faced the added real-time terror of receiving an instant verdict on their work in person, like the conductor being pummeled with a barrage of rotten fruit halfway through the Paris premiere of Rite of Spring, or Bob Dylan being hooted off the stage the first time he appeared live with an electric guitar. No wonder artists so often harbor a depressing sense that their work is going downhill. At any given moment, the older work is always more attractive, always better understood. This is not good. After all, wanting to be understood is a basic need, an affirmation of the humanity you share with everyone around you. The risk is fearsome. In making your real work, you hand the audience the power to deny the understanding you seek. You hand them the power to say, "You're not like us. You're weird. You're crazy." And admittedly, there's always a chance they may be right. Your work may provide clear evidence that you are different, that you are alone. After all, artists themselves rarely serve as role models of normalcy. As Ben Shahn rather wryly commented, "It may be a point of great pride to have a Van Gogh on the living room wall, but the prospect of having Van Gogh himself in the living room would put a great many devoted art lovers to rout." Put that way, platitudes about the virtues of individuality sound distinctly hollow. Just how unintelligible your art, or you, appear to others, may be something you don't really want to confront. At least not all that quickly. What is sometimes needed is simply an insulating period, a gap of pure time between the making of your art and the time when you share it with outsiders. Andrew Wyeth pursued his Helga series privately for years, working at his own pace, away from the spotlight of criticism and suggestion that would otherwise have accompanied the release of each new piece in the series. Such respites also, perhaps, allow the finished work time to find its rightful place in the artist's heart and mind. In short, a chance to be understood better by the maker. Then, when the time comes for others to judge the work, their reaction, whatever it may be, is less threatening. Conversely, Catering to fears of being misunderstood leaves you dependent upon your audience. In the simplest yet most deadly scenario, ideas are diluted to what you imagine your audience can imagine, leading to work that is condescending, arrogant, or both. Worse yet, you discard your own highest vision in the process. In the face of such pressures, it's heartening to find contemporary role models even among those who made it their goal to address the mass audience. Charles Eames and Jacob Bronowski consistently placed trust in the potential of their audience to grow and benefit from new ideas. Eames once designed a museum exhibit that featured a 15-foot-long wall chart, set in textbook-sized type and equally small pictures, delineating the entire history of mathematics. When asked who on earth would possibly read the whole wall, he calmly replied that each person would probably absorb about as much as he/she were able to, and just slough off the rest. And, he added, that would include some who would make connections between the data beyond what Eames himself could perceive. Acceptance. For the artist, the issue of acceptance begins as one simple, haunting question. When your work is counted, will it be counted as art? It's a basic question, with antecedents stretching back to childhood. Remember those dreaded playground rituals when you'd feel badly enough if you weren't the first one chosen for the softball team, but would rather die than not be chosen at all? If the need for acceptance is the need to have your work accepted as art, then the accompanying fear is finding it dismissed as craft, hobby, decoration, or as nothing at all. In 1937, when Beaumont Newhall wrote the first substantive account of the history of photography, titled, logically enough, The History of Photography, he picked a select number of artists to praise or criticize. As it turned out, the photographers hurt by Newhall's book were not those he damned, but those he left out entirely. In the public's mind, the former at least became part of the history of photography, while the latter ceased to exist entirely. Literally decades passed before some talented outsees began receiving recognition for the work they produced in those early days. That example is extreme, but the general caveat still applies. Acceptance and approval are powers held by others, whether they be friends, classmates, curators, or author of the definitive history of your chosen medium. At some point, the need for acceptance may well collide head-on with the need to do your own work. It's too bad, since the request itself seems so reasonable. You want to do your own work, and you want acceptance for that. It's the ballad of the cowboy and the mountain man, the myth of artistic integrity and Sesame Street. Sing the song of your heart, and sooner or later the world will accept and reward the authentic voice. Jaded sophisticates laugh at this belief, but usually buy into it, along with everyone else anyway. In the non-art world, this belief system is a driving mechanism behind the American dream, and the midlife crisis. In the art world, it's a primary buffer against disillusionment. After all, the world does, in large measure, reward authentic work. The problem is not absolute, but temporal. By the time your reward arrives, you may no longer be around to collect it. Ask Schubert. There's a fairly straightforward explanation for this. At any given moment, the world offers vastly more support to work it already understands. Namely, art that's already been around for a generation or a century. Expressions of truly new ideas often fail to qualify as even bad art. They're simply viewed as no art at all. Stravinsky's Firebird, today considered one of the more lushly melodic of 20th century symphonic pieces, was rejected as sheer cacophony when first performed. Robert Frank's The Americans, now considered a seminal turning point in American photography, was at the time of its publication largely ignored by a press and public that couldn't decipher its dark and gritty vision. It's a dreary tradition. Artists from Ajay to Ouija were ignored through most of their careers, because the work they produced didn't fit within the established definition of art. For the artist, the dilemma seems obvious. Risk rejection by exploring new worlds, or court acceptance by following well-explored paths. Needless to say, the latter strategy is the overwhelming drug of choice where acceptance is the primary goal. Make work that looks like art, and acceptance is automatic. Surprisingly, however, this is not always a bad thing. At least for the novitiate, some period of artistic recapitulation is both inevitable and, by most accounts, beneficial. On both intellectual and technical grounds, it's wise to remain on good terms with your artistic heritage, lest you devote several incarnations to reinventing the wheel. But once having allowed for that, the far greater danger is not that the artist will fail to learn anything from the past, but will fail to teach anything new to the future. Recent photo history offers a textbook example of the perils that success itself can lay in the path of continued artistic growth. In the first third of this century, Edward Weston, Ansel Adams, and a few fellow travelers turned the then-prevailing world of soft-focus photographic art upside down. They did so by developing a visual philosophy that justified sharply focused images and introduced the natural landscape as a subject for photographic art. It took decades for their viewpoint to filter into public consciousness, but it sure has now. Pictures appearing in anything from cigarette ads to Sierra Club books owe their current acceptance to those once controversial images. Indeed, that vision has so pervasively become ours that people photographing vacation scenery today often do so with the hope that if everything turns out just right, the result will not simply look like a landscape, it will look like an Ansel Adams photograph of the landscape. This, too, will pass, of course. In fact, artistically speaking, it has passed. The unfolding over time of a great idea is like the growth of a fractal crystal, allowing details and refinements to multiply endlessly, but only in ever-decreasing scale. Eventually, perhaps by the early 1960s, those who stepped forward to carry the West Coast landscape photography banner were not producing art so much as reproducing the history of art. Separated two or three generations from the forces that spawned the vision they championed, they were left making images of experiences they never quite had. If you find yourself caught in similar circumstances, we modestly offer this bit of cowboy wisdom. When your horse dies, get off. Cowboy wisdom notwithstanding, the Weston Adams vision continues to support a sizable cottage industry of artists and teachers even today. But this security carries a price. Risk-taking is discouraged, artistic development stunted, and personal style sublimated to fit a pre-existing mold. Only those who commit to following their own artistic path can look back and see this issue in clear perspective. The real question about acceptance is not whether your work will be viewed as art, but whether it will be viewed as your art. Approval. The difference between acceptance and approval is subtle but distinct. Acceptance means having your work counted as the real thing. Approval means having people like it. It's not unusual to receive one without the other. Norman Rockwell's work was enormously well-liked during his lifetime, but received little critical respect. A generation or two earlier, there was widespread agreement that John Singer Sargent was good, but that for various reasons his work didn't really count. On the flip side, every season brings a small bundle of films and plays that garner rave critical reviews while on their way to becoming box office disasters. That this dichotomy exists is understandable. Whether it need be destructive is an open question. Both acceptance and approval are, quite plainly, audience-related issues. In a healthy environment, good work would get recognition. If your only validation is internal, society has failed. Sounds straightforward enough, but society is hardly a monolith, It harbors many environments, some repressive to the artist, others supportive. For artists who thrive on confrontation, rejection is not a problem. But for many others, the constant wear and tear takes a toll. For those artists, survival means finding an environment where art is valued and art-making encouraged. In a supportive environment, one found more often than not within the artistic community itself, approval and acceptance often become linked, even indistinguishable. The operative criteria for this rather select audience is typified by Ed Ruscha's remark, "There are only artists and hacks," or James Thurber's observation, "There's no such thing as good art or bad art. There's only art, and damn little of it." But be forewarned, this approach can be harsh. There's a story, perhaps apocryphal, of the master who was asked to judge a competition for 20 young pianists by rating their performance on a scale of 1 to 100. Afterwards, his tally sheet revealed he had awarded 2 pianists a perfect 100 and given the rest a 0. When the sponsors protested, he replied bluntly, "Either you can play or you can't." Filmmaker Lou Stueman tells the painfully unapocryphal story about hand-carrying his first film, produced while he was still a student, to the famed teacher and film theorist Slavko Forkapich. The teacher watched the entire film in silence, and as the viewing ended, rose and left the room without uttering a word. Stueman, more than a bit shaken, ran out after him and asked, "But what did you think of my film?" Replied Forkapich, "What film?" The lesson here is simply that courting approval, even that of peers, puts a dangerous amount of power in the hands of the audience. Worse yet, the audience is seldom in a position to grant or withhold approval on the one issue that really counts, namely, whether or not you're making progress in your work. They're in a good position to comment on how they're moved, or challenged, or entertained by the finished product, but have little knowledge or interest in your process. Audience comes later. The only pure communication is between you and your work. 5. Finding your work. You could not step twice into the same river, for other waters are ever flowing on to you. Heraclitus, circa 540 to 480 BC. The world displays perfect neutrality on whether we achieve any outward manifestation of our inner desires. But not art. Art is exquisitely responsive. Nowhere is feedback so absolute as in the making of art. The work we make, even if unnoticed and undesired by the world, vibrates in perfect harmony to everything we put into it, or withhold from it. In the outside world, there may be no reaction to what we do. In our artwork, there is nothing but reaction. The breathtakingly wonderful thing about this reaction is its truthfulness. Look at your work, and it tells you how it is when you hold back or when you embrace. When you are lazy, your art is lazy. When you hold back, it holds back. When you hesitate, it stands there staring, hands in its pockets. But when you commit, it comes on like blazes. Recently, out of pleasure alone, an accomplished visual artist took up dance. Never before experiencing an art form so purely physical, she threw herself into it. Her involvement became intense. More classes, more practice, more commitment, longer hours. She excelled. Then one day, several months into it, her instructor asked her to consider joining a performing troupe. She froze. Her dancing fell apart. She became stiff and self-conscious. She got serious, or serious in a different way. She didn't feel she was good enough, and her dancing promptly was not good enough. She got frustrated and depressed enough that she had to quit for a few weeks to sort things out. More recently, back to work on a new but shaky ground, She's having to teach herself to enjoy working hard for others at the art she previously enjoyed passionately for herself. In the ideal, that is to say, real artist, fears not only continue to exist, they exist side by side with the desires that complement them, perhaps drive them, certainly feed them. Naive passion, which promotes work done in ignorance of obstacles, becomes, with courage, informed passion, which promotes work done in full acceptance of those obstacles. Foremost among those obstacles is uncertainty. We all know the feeling of finished art that rides from within its uncertainties. Music, with its dense structure and built-in abstraction, offers the clearest examples. In performances of really wonderful music, there's an ongoing tension between where the musical line is and where we know it needs to go. We're uncertain, momentarily, just how the fugue can be resolved, even as, simultaneously, we know it will be. What is more difficult to describe is the state of mind held by the artist while working on the piece. Most artists keep a well-rehearsed speech close at hand for fielding the familiar request to explain a finished piece. But if asked to describe how it felt during the art-making, well, that often comes out a bit like Dorothy trying to describe the Land of Oz to Auntie Em. Between the initial idea and the finished piece lies a gulf we can see across but never fully chart. The truly special moments in art-making lie in those moments when concept is converted to reality, those moments when the gulf is being crossed. Precise descriptions fail, but it connects to that wonderful condition in which the work seems to make itself, and the artist serves only as guide or mediator, allowing all things to be possible. All things considered, in most matters of art, it is more nourishing to be a maker than a viewer. But not in all matters. When it comes to the range of art we can usefully engage, some benefits that flow freely to art viewers remain tantalizingly inaccessible to art makers. As a listener, you can be transported to authentic ecstasy and catharsis by a performance of the Bach B minor Mass. But as a maker, you cannot compose even the most trivial piece of authentic Baroque music. As a viewer, you can feel the charge in the presence of the Plains Indian medicine bundle, but as a 20th century artist, you could not begin to make one yourself. Your reach as a viewer is vastly greater than your reach as a maker. The art you can experience may have originated 1,000 miles away or 1,000 years ago, but the art you can make is irrevocably bound to the times and places of your life, limited by the very ground on which you stand. Without a broadly shared belief in the symbolism of the cross and the promise of heaven above, the cruciform design and towering spires of the great European cathedrals would have made no sense whatsoever. Seen against the vast sweep of history, it is only for brief moments that particular events and beliefs carry the power to compel us to build cathedrals or write fugues. And it's just as likely that a similarly narrow, albeit different, range of beliefs drives all that is authentically available to us in this moment. Decisive works of art participate directly in the fabric of history surrounding their maker. Simply put, you have to be there. The surprising, and probably disturbing, corollary to this is that we don't learn much about making art from being moved by it. Making art is bound by where we are, and the experience of art we have as viewers is not a reliable guide to where we are. As viewers, we readily experience the power of ground on which we cannot stand, yet that very experience can be so compelling that we may feel almost honor-bound to make art that recaptures that power. Or, more dangerously, feel tempted to use the same techniques, the same subjects, the same symbols as appear in the work that aroused our passion, to borrow, in effect, a charge from another time and place. It's not hard to track the source of such desire. Our most personal histories hold crystalline memories of absorption into evocative work. Sometimes such moments are part of why we become artists, and the works that moved us take on heroic importance. I can remember to within one heartbeat the moment I first saw an Edward Weston print. As I was walking the dim hallway that leads to the rare book room of the UCLA library, I glanced up and saw this photograph. I stopped walking. Confusion. It was unlike anything else I had seen. It was so much more something than other photographs, particularly my photographs. It was different in kind. In that instant, an unbidden distinction formed in my gut. There were now two kinds of photographs in the world, the one before me on the wall, and all the rest. That photograph was mine to experience, but neither it nor anything like it was mine to make. Yet it took a decade to dispel the gnawing feeling that my work should do what that work had done, and more years still before I thought to question where the power of such art resided. In the maker? In the artwork? In the viewer? If indeed, for any given time, only a certain sort of work resonates with life, then that is the work you need to be doing in that moment. If you try to do some other work, you will miss your moment. Indeed, our own work is so inextricably tied to time and place that we cannot recapture even our own aesthetic ground of past times. Try, if you can, to reoccupy your own aesthetic space of a few years back, or even a few months. There is no way. You can only plunge ahead, even when that carries with it the bittersweet realization that you have already done your very best work. This heightened self-consciousness was rarely an issue in earlier times, when it seemed self-evident that the artist, and everyone else for that matter, had roots deeply intertwining their culture. Meanings and distinctions embodied within artworks were part of the fabric of everyday life, and the distance from art issues to all other issues was small. The whole population counted as audience when artists' work encompassed everything from icons for the church to utensils for the home. In the Greek amphitheater 2,200 years ago, the plays of Euripides were performed as contemporary theater before an audience of 14,000. Not so today. Today, art issues have, for the most part, become solely the concern of artists, divorced from, and ignored by, the larger community. Today, artists often back away from engaging the times and places of their life, choosing instead the largely intellectual challenge of engaging the times and places of art. But it's an artificial construct that begins and ends at the gallery door. Apart from the readership of Art Forum, remarkably few people lose sleep trying to incorporate gender-neutral biomorphic deconstructivism into their personal lives. As Adam Gopnik remarked in The New Yorker, postmodernist art is, above all, post-audience art. In such a setting, artists strain to find material of any human consequence. Under pressure of impending irrelevance, they may begin to fill their canvases and monitors with charged particles appropriated from other places and times. It is as though art itself confers universality upon its subject, as though in art all objects automatically retain their power, as though you could incorporate the power of the Plains Indian medicine bundle into your work, or convincingly complete the closing movements to Schubert's unfinished symphony. Today, indeed, you can find urban white artists, people who could not reliably tell a coyote from a German shepherd at 100 feet, casually incorporating the figure of Coyote the Trickster into their work. A premise common to all such efforts is that power can be borrowed across space and time. It cannot. There's a difference between meaning that is embodied and meaning that is referenced. As someone once said, no one should wear a Greek fisherman's hat except a Greek fisherman. Canon. If you're like most artists we know, you're probably accustomed to watching your work unfold smoothly enough for long stretches of time, until one day, for no immediately apparent reason, it doesn't. Hitting that unexpected rift is commonplace to the point of cliché. Yet artists commonly treat each recurring instance as somber evidence of their own personal failure. Nominees for leading role in a continuing artist's funk are 1. You've entirely run out of new ideas forever, or 2. You've been following a worthless dead-end path the whole time. And the winner is, fortunately, neither. One of the best-kept secrets of art-making is that new ideas come into play far less frequently than practical ideas. Ideas that can be reused for 1,000 variations, supplying the framework for a whole body of work rather than a single piece. And likewise, fear that you've been following the wrong ideas is merely the downside variant of the common fantasies about the way things could have been. The promise of paths not taken is that our work is really more than it appears, that it would shine through better if only things had been a little bit different. Confronting a disappointing piece, one somehow wants to disown it, to say, "That's not what I meant to do. I should have made it larger. Or maybe smaller. If only I'd had more time or money or hadn't used that stupid green paint." We'd all love to squirm out of this one, but the undeniable fact is that your art is not some residue left when you subtract all the things you haven't done. It is the full payoff for all the things you have done. One might as well wish for indulgence to go back and pick better numbers for last week's lottery. Time travelers and tabloid psychics aside, the rest of us directly engage only today, today. And when you watch your work unfold day by day, piece by piece, there's no escaping cause and effect. Simply put, what you did got you here, and if you apply the same methods again, you will likely get the same result again. This is true not just for being stuck, but for all other artistic states as well, including highly productive states. As a practical matter, ideas and methods that work usually continue to work. If you were working smoothly and now you are stuck, chances are you unnecessarily altered some approach that was already working perfectly well. For years, I set aside daytimes for art making and evenings for writing. At some point, I reversed that schedule, and months passed before I realized my writing had dried up, not for lack of ideas, but because it turns out I process words better at midnight than at midday. When things go haywire, your best opening strategy might be to return, very carefully and consciously, to the habits and practices in play the last time you felt good about the work. Return to the space you drifted away from and, sometimes at least, the work will return as well. And sometimes it won't. Artists, like everyone else, have a certain conceptual inertia, a tendency to keep to their own compass heading even as the world itself veers off another direction. When Columbus returned from the New World and proclaimed the Earth was round, almost everyone else went right on believing the Earth was flat. Then they died, and the next generation grew up believing the world was round. That's how people change their minds. That's also to say that usually, but not always, the piece you produce tomorrow will be shaped, purely and simply, by the tools you hold in your hand today. In that sense, the history of art is also the history of technology. The frescoes of pre-Renaissance Italy, the tempera paintings of Flanders, the plein air oils of southern France, the acrylics of New York City. Each successive technology imparted characteristic color and saturation, brushstroke and texture, sensuality or formality to the art piece. Simply put, certain tools make certain results possible. Your tools do more than just influence the appearance of the resulting art. They basically set limits upon what you can say with an art piece. And when particular tools and materials disappear, because knowledge of how to make or use them is lost, artistic possibilities are lost as well. The sound of Baroque instruments, the impression of the letterpress, the tonality of platinum prints, count these among the endangered species of art-making. And likewise, when new tools appear, new artistic possibilities arise. A scene painted from life, for instance, reveals a world far different from the one painted from memory. This became evident in the 1870s, when manufacturers found a way to seal oil colors in collapsible metal foil tubes, and for the first time artists working in that medium had the option of leaving the studio and painting with oils directly in the field. Some did, and some didn't. Those who did became known as the Impressionists. The dilemma every artist confronts again and again is when to stick with familiar tools and materials, and when to reach out and embrace those that offer new possibilities. And on average, the younger artist tends to experiment with a large and varied range of tools and materials, while the veteran artist tends to employ a small and specific set. In time, as an artist's gestures become more assured, the chosen tools become almost an extension of the artist's own spirit. In time, exploration gives way to expression. Either way, however, there is always one large obstacle to making mid-course corrections in our working methods. We hardly know what the methods themselves are. And when the work is going well, why on earth would we want to know? Most of the myriad of steps that go into making a piece, or a year's worth of pieces, go on below the level of conscious thought, engaging unarticulated beliefs and assumptions about what art making is. They remain as unknown and unconsidered as the steps we take in deciding whether to burnish the plate with straight or with circular strokes. Ask yourself why, for instance, you listen to country western music while you're painting. Does it encourage you to choose brighter colors? Why do you leave your studio unheated even when it means working with your overcoat on? Does it make your brush strokes crisper? How do you sense when the dampened paper wants to take the watercolors? By touch? Smell? The limpness of the paper? We rarely think about how or why we do such things. We just do them. Changing the pattern of outcome in your work means first identifying things about your approach that are as automatic as wedging the clay, as subtle as releasing the arrow from the bow. The details of art making we do recognize tend to be hard-won practical working habits and recurrent bits of form that we can repeatedly hang work on. Sometimes on dull days I've said to myself half aloud that if I just go into the studio and start a wet piece, I'll at least have to finish something before it dries. We use predictable work habits to get us into the studio and into our materials. We use recurrent bits of form as starting points for making specific pieces. Considering the number of mazurkas he wrote, we have to think that once Chopin found that musical form, he must have been a happier composer. It's easy to imagine that he could sit at the piano most any time and begin to vamp in that oddly syncopated three-quarter time, gradually building it into a small-scale piece. For Chopin, that form was so conducive to exploration and variation, he was able to reuse it for years. Equally, it must have been just plain helpful when J.S. Bach committed to writing a prelude and fugue in each of the 24 keys, since each time he sat down to compose, he at least had a place to start. Let's see. I haven't begun to work on the F-sharp minor yet. Working within the self-imposed discipline of a particular form eases the prospect of having to reinvent yourself with each new piece. The discovery of useful forms is precious. Once found, they should never be abandoned for trivial reasons. It's easy to imagine today's art instructor cautioning Chopin the mazurka thing is getting a little repetitive, that the work is not progressing. Well, true, it may not have been progressing, but that's not the issue. Writing mazurkas may have been useful only to Chopin, as a vehicle for getting back into the work and as a place to begin making the next piece. For most artists, making good art depends upon making lots of art, and any device that carries the first brushstroke to the next blank canvas has tangible, practical value. Only the maker, and then only with time, has a chance of knowing how important small conventions and rituals are in the practice of staying at work. The private details of art-making are utterly uninteresting to audiences, and frequently to teachers, perhaps because they're almost never visible, or even knowable, from examining the finished work. Hemingway, for instance, mounted his typewriter at counter height, and did all his writing while standing up. If he wasn't standing, he wasn't typing. Of course, that odd habit isn't visible in his stories. But were he denied that habit, there probably wouldn't be any stories. The hardest part of art making is living your life in such a way that your work gets done, over and over. And that means, among other things, finding a host of practices that are just plain useful. A piece of art is the surface expression of a life lived within productive patterns. Over time, the life of a productive artist becomes filled with useful conventions and practical methods, so that a string of finished pieces continues to appear at the surface. And in truly happy moments, those artistic gestures move beyond simple procedure and acquire an inherent aesthetic all their own. They are your artistic hearth and home, the working places to be that link form and feeling. They become, like the dark colors and asymmetrical lilt of the mazurka, inseparable from the life of their maker. They are canons. They allow confidence and concentration. They allow not knowing. They allow the automatic and unarticulated to remain so. Once you have found the work you are meant to do, the particulars of any single piece don't matter all that much. Part 2. When bankers get together for dinner, they discuss art. When artists get together for dinner, they discuss money. Oscar Wilde. 6. A view into the outside world. To see far is one thing. Going there is another. Brancusi. To the artist, all problems of art appear uniquely personal. Well, that's understandable enough, given that not many other activities routinely call one's basic self-worth into question. But those really personal problems all relate to the making of the art. Once the art has been made, an entirely new set of problems arise. Problems that require the artist to engage the outside world. Call them ordinary problems. Ordinary problems. Ordinary problems are not, however, trivial problems. Among other things, they consume the larger part of almost every artist's time. One well-known painter, after several months of careful record-keeping, reached the discouraging conclusion that even at best he could free up only 6 or 7 days a month for actually painting, while the remaining 20-odd days inevitably went to gallery business, studio cleanup, UPS runs, and the like. Moral: there's one hell of a lot more to art than just making it. In many cases, the art you make today will reach its audience tomorrow only because of a vast societal network geared to arts education, funding, criticism, publication, exhibition, and performance. In many other cases, unfortunately, your art will only reach the world in spite of this network. Many attempts to introduce art to the larger world simply give evidence of the uneasy fit in our society between economics and beliefs. In many quarters, art is viewed as dangerous, unnecessary, elitist, expensive, and dependent on the patronage of effete East Coast liberals for its survival. Artists themselves fare little better, being widely portrayed as subversive weirdos who not only enjoy living in sin, but are probably doing it off your tax dollars as well. Having said that, the authors would like to employ this sentence to proclaim a self-imposed moratorium on cynicism in their future discussions, regardless of how much the bastards deserve it. Thank you, the management. In any case, there's nothing obscure about either the cause or the effect of these attitudes. Some art, by its very nature, is subversive. By leading the viewer to experience the world through the very different sensibilities of the artist, a good work of art inevitably calls the viewer's own belief system into question. Is this threatening? Is the Pope Catholic? The more effective the art, the more likely the viewer's first reaction will be anger and denial, followed immediately by a search for someone to blame. And in that department, the artist is always the most likely candidate. We have, after all, a time-honored tradition of killing the messenger who delivers the bad news. One of the more celebrated examples of mowing down the messenger, and everyone else in sight, involved Robert Mapplethorpe, a photographer who made a set of images overtly romanticizing homosexuality. As it turned out, threats didn't mean a lot to Mapplethorpe, who was already terminally ill, even as he readied this body of work for exhibit. Instead, pressure points were found in the supporting arts network, especially the National Endowment for the Arts. Subtlety was not in great abundance here. The NEA was simply threatened with a cutoff of funding if it lent support to artists or museums that made or exhibited work that offended community standards. There were counter-protests, of course, and in the end Mapplethorpe's work was exhibited, but the message to the arts community was clear. Stray too far from the innocuous, and the axe would fall. Call it selective censorship. Freedom of expression was guaranteed, unless it was expressed in a work of art. The most amazing aspect of this American morality play was not that the government would place self-interest above principle when it felt threatened, but that no one foresaw this coming from miles down the road. A reminder from history, the American Revolution was not financed with matching grants from the Crown. Common ground. It goes without saying that censorship is debilitating to the artist. It is a little less obvious, at least to artists, that censorship is an entirely natural state of affairs. Nature places a simple constraint on those who leave the flock to go their own way. They get eaten. In society, it's a bit more complicated. Nonetheless, the admonition stands. Avoiding the unknown has considerable survival value. Society, nature, and art-making tend to produce guarded creatures. The dilemma here is that for the artist, contact with subject and materials must always remain unguarded. In making art, you court the unknown, and with it the paranoia of those who fear what change might bring. But while fear of attracting the wrath of some southern senator may cast a shadow on your freedom of expression, often the more vexing problem is catching anyone's attention in the first place. After all, most people see no reason to question their own beliefs, much less solicit yours. And why should they? Artistically and otherwise, the world we come into has already been observed and defined by others, thoroughly, redundantly, comprehensively, and usually quite appropriately. The human race has spent several millennia developing a huge and robust set of observations about the world, in forms as varied as language, art, and religion. Those observations in turn have withstood many, enormously many, tests. We stand heir to an unstatably large set of meanings. Most of what we inherit is so clearly correct it goes unseen. It fits the world seamlessly. It is the world. But despite its richness and variability, the well-defined world we inherit doesn't quite fit each one of us individually. Most of us spend most of our time in other people's worlds, working at predetermined jobs, relaxing to prepackaged entertainment, and no matter how benign this ready-made world may be, there will always be times when something is missing or doesn't quite ring true. And so you make your place in the world by making part of it, by contributing some new part to the set. And surely one of the more astonishing rewards of art-making comes when people make time to visit the world you have created. Some, indeed, may even purchase a piece of your world to carry back and adopt as their own. Each new piece of your art enlarges our reality. The world is not yet done. Art issues. It seems harmless enough to observe here that having an MFA or even a knowledge of modern art should hardly be a prerequisite to making art. After all, art appeared long before art departments, long before anyone began classifying or collecting artists' works. Nonetheless, most artists today do have formal training in art, a familiarity with the current art world trends, and at least some dependence on galleries or academia for their livelihood. This is understandable, if not exactly healthy, given that each link in the arts network has a vested interest in defining its own role as fundamental and necessary. One of the ordinary problems artists face is finding a way to make peace with the arts network and the issues it holds dear. Not necessarily joining it, mind you, just making peace with it. At least you need to if you want assurance your work will likely be shown, published, or performed in any reasonable length of time. If the need to get shown is strong enough, this is not a problem. But the unease many artists feel today betrays a lack of fit between the work of their heart and the emotionally remote concerns of curators, publishers, and promoters. It's hard to overstate the magnitude of this problem. Finding your place in the art world is no easy matter, if indeed there is a place for you at all. In fact, one of the few sure things about the contemporary art scene is that someone besides you is deciding which art and which artists belong in it. It's been a tough century for modesty, craftsmanship, and tenderness. Competition. There's no denying competition. It's hardwired into us. It's chemical. Good athletes bank on that surge of energy that arises in the instant of knowing they can overtake the runner just ahead. Good artists thrive on exhibit and publication deadlines, on working 20 hours straight to see the pots are glazed and fired just so, on making their next work better than their last. The urge to compete provides a source of raw energy, and for that purpose alone it can be exceptionally useful. In a healthy artistic environment, that energy is directed inward to fulfill one's own potential. In a healthy artistic environment, artists are not in competition with each other. Unfortunately, healthy artistic environments are about as common as unicorns. We live in a society that encourages competition at demonstrably vicious levels and sets a hard and accountable yardstick for judging who wins. It's easier to rate artists in terms of the recognition they've received, which is easily compared, than in terms of the pieces they've made, which may be as different as apples and waltzes. And when that happens, competition centers not on making work but on collecting the symbols of acceptance and approval of that work. NEA grants, a show at Galerie du Jour, a celebrity profile in The New Yorker, and the like. Taken to extremes, such competition slides into needless and often self-destructive comparison with the fortunes of others. W.C. Fields became enraged at the mere mention of Charlie Chaplin's name. Milton suffered lifelong depression from ongoing self-comparison with Shakespeare. Salieri went a bit more insane each time he compared his music to Mozart's. And who among us would welcome that comparison? Fear that you're not getting your fair share of recognition leads to anger and bitterness. Fear that you're not as good as a fellow artist leads to depression. Admittedly, few of us are above feeling a momentary stab of pain when someone else wins the fellowship we sought, or a secret rush of triumph when we scoop up the same prize. Kingsley Amis allowed that when he'd start writing a new novel, part of his motive was, "I'm going to show them this time." But occasional competitive grousing is a healthy step removed from equating success with standing atop the bodies of your peers. If nothing else, it's hard to claim victory when your imagined competitors may be entirely unaware of your existence. After all, some may have already been dead for a century. Quite plausibly, they don't win, while you, sooner or later, will lose. In some forms of comparison, defeat is all but inevitable. But regardless of the yardstick used, all competitors share one telling characteristic. They know where they rank in the pack. Avid competitors check their ranking constantly. Obsessive competitors simply equate rank with self, a chancy gambit, but one that works, when it does work, by tapping a source of energy that makes them work harder at their art, and almost always makes them good careerists. When sense of self depends so directly upon the ranking bestowed by the outside world, motivation to produce work that brings high ratings is extreme. In not knowing how to tell yourself that your work is okay, you may be driven to the top of the heap in trying to get the rest of the world to tell you. In theory, this is a perfectly valid approach. The tricky part is finding the right yardstick for measuring your accomplishments. What makes competition in the arts a slippery issue is simply that there's rarely any consensus about what your best work is. Moreover, what's important about each new piece is not whether it is better or worse than your previous efforts, but the ways in which it is similar or different. The meaningful comparison between two Bach fugues is not how they rank, but how they work. When things go really well in your art making, all the pieces you make have a life to them, regardless of how they stack up as personal favorites. After all, they're all your babies. It can even be argued that you have an obligation to explore the possible variations, given that a single artistic question can yield many right answers. Productive times encourage you to build an extended body of work, one where all the pieces, even the flawed sketches that will never see the gallery wall, have a chance to play. In healthy times, you rarely pause to distinguish between internal drive, sense of craft, the pressure of a deadline, or the charm of a new idea. They all serve as sources of energy in the pieces you make. Navigating the system. Artists, it turns out, are a crafty lot, and surprisingly adept at getting the system to foot the bill for letting them do exactly what they wanted to do anyway. Michelangelo painted the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel on commission from the church. Ansel Adams photographed Moonrise Hernandez on assignment for the Department of the Interior. Eames Furniture and Avedon Fashion Spreads prove that art can prevail even at the extremes of commerce and fluff. Indeed, a disconcertingly strong argument can be made for the proposition that many artworks, especially large-scale efforts like the Parthenon or the Vietnam War Memorial, have had a buyer in place before the artwork was begun. The problem is to keep such command performances from tainting the work that follows, since commissioned art has a way of sliding slowly and imperceptibly into commercial trade. This is especially troublesome for art forms that have widespread and high-paying commercial applications. The challenge in such circumstances is to convince the patron that you alone know the right way to make the piece. For some artists, it's a trade-off, or perhaps a standoff. At Christmas time, ballet companies, even the major players, offer an inordinate number of performances of The Nutcracker, that being the only ballet that generates enough ticket sales to pull them through the rest of the season. Likewise, printmakers, without altering the content of their work, learn soon enough which images will likely justify the cost of running a large edition. For many other artists, however, the Arts Network proves an unmitigated disaster. Sometimes it's just that the freewheeling thought patterns that lead to art making don't lead as gracefully to tidy record keeping. More often, though, the same artists who diligently follow a self-imposed discipline, like writing in iambic pentameter or composing for solo piano, prove singularly ill-equipped to handle constraints imposed by others. Edward Weston's well-meaning friends once convinced a coffee company to offer that artist a commission to make still-life photographs they could use in their magazine ads. About the only requirement was that the company's product appear somewhere in the arrangement. Nonetheless, Weston, whose facility with photographing small objects as art is legendary, was driven to complete distraction by the pressure of having to make one of those small objects a coffee can. Ideally, at least from the artist's viewpoint, the Arts Network is there to handle all those details not central to the art-making process. This is a healthy attitude to nurture, since some art forms